It's a very simple question. Have you ever done something really stupid? We like raise our hands. Anyone's ever, you ever done something and then, you know, later on, a little while later, you're kind of like, oh, no. Right? You ever done one of those moments where you just forget everything about your normal human sense and you just do something really, really stupid? I have titled today's sermon, Screwing Up and Repenting. I was trying to think of something elegant and pretty and cool, and screwing up was the best title I came up with. Because today we're going to look at King David, this amazing man of the faith, this amazing man in the Bible, and how he royally, epically screws up and sins. And then we're going to look at what is his response to his sin when he does that. So as we get in this, my key question for us today is not just don't sin or how to not sin. What I want us to look at as we read the story about David and as we look at this is, when you do sin and when you do that really, really stupid thing, because we all do those really, really stupid things at times. It's just, we're human. And when that happens, what I want to look at is, how do you respond to that? What do you do for that? Perhaps you're in a situation where you've done something in your life recently or in the past year, and it's been holding onto your mind or your heart. What do you do when you sin, when you feel like you failed, when you failed God, when you failed the people around you? How do you respond, and what do you do with that? So if you got your Bibles, open up to 2 Samuel chapter 11. 2 Samuel chapter 11, that's about a fourth of the way in your Bible. And we're going to start reading in verse 1. And to kind of give the context, last month we were talking about David and we talked about all these awesome, great stories. David, this is amazing, a man. Everything we talked about last month was before David was a king. And now where we are in this month, 2 Samuel, last month was 1 Samuel, this month 2 Samuel. This month, David has become the king. He's become the king. He's this great warrior. He conquers everyone. He unites all of the Israelites. The pinnacle, the greatest king they ever had. David is just an amazing, amazing man. And he's been winning all of these victories. And everything is going great and according to plan until chapter 11, verse 1. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. Joab is the leader of the army. They destroyed the Ammonites and they besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. One evening, David got up from his bed and he walked around on the roof of the palace. From the roof, he saw a woman bathing. Uh-oh. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. And the man said, "Isn't this Bathsheba, the daughter of Elam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite?" Now, unless you're just a really big Bible nerd, which if you are, that's cool, I'm guessing you probably don't know who these people are and their crazy names. And so to kind of just put this in perspective, the man is saying this woman's name is Bathsheba. She's the daughter of a man named Elam, and she's the wife of a man named Uriah. The reason that's important, you don't have to flip there, but at the end of Samuel, there's a list of men called David's mighty men. One day later on, we're going to do a sermon on those men. But David's mighty men. There's 30 of them, and these are the highest ranking officers in all of David's army. They're the most loyal, the most devout, the greatest soldiers he have. And there's story after story of them putting their life on the line for David. Constantly, they put their life on the line for David, the most loyal, devout, best soldiers he has. Elam, Bathsheba's father, is one of the mighty men. And Uriah the Hittite, Bathsheba's husband, is one of David's mighty men. So this is not some random person. This is one of, out of 30 people, of the closest, most trusted, best, loyal people David has. It is this woman who is one of them is his father, one of them is their wife. That's who this woman is. Then, verse 4, David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. She had purified herself from her uncleanness. Then she went back home, and the woman conceived, and he sent word to David saying, "I am pregnant." The words "I am pregnant" are the greatest or scariest words you've ever heard in your life, depending on your situation. And in this situation, I think it is probably the scariest category. And some of you might be thinking, when we read this story, We read this, we see what happens. He sees this beautiful woman, she's bathing. He asks her to come to his room. He's the king, he can do whatever he wants. So he gets her to come to her, they sleep together, and she gets pregnant. Some of you may be thinking, some of us think, when we read this story and say, well, she shouldn't have been doing that. Bathsheba shouldn't have been bathing out in public somehow where David could see her. And so we will say things like, she shouldn't be doing that, and we'll say things in our society like, that girl shouldn't be wearing that, and because she was wearing that, that's why I did this. What I mean by that is a man or a woman, it can be either one, who says, you know, that woman was wearing that, and so that attracted me, and that's why I ended up doing A, B, C, D, going down this road. My whole point with this is you can say whatever you want about Bathsheba. Bible scholars say a lot of things about her, good and bad. No one really knows. The story is not about Bathsheba. The story is about what David did in the situation he was put in. And my whole point is another person's foolish deeds and bad behavior does not justify your foolish deeds and bad behavior in response. It doesn't matter if what Bathsheba was doing good or right. Some people say it was just a cultural thing, so it wasn't bad. Some people say she's purposely doing that. The story doesn't really care about that part. The whole point is that when David is presented with this, he does something bad. And it doesn't matter what's in front of him because David's choice and David's action is on him. He's responsible for his own action. So men and women, no matter what situation you are in life, no matter how good looking that person is or no matter how close emotionally you are to them, none of those excuses and reasons justify a foolish deed or action in return, right? And this applies to anything in life. Just because someone else does something bad, your response in return is not justified to do something bad back. And the second thing I want to, before we move on, to put out is just to make sure it's clear, women are beautiful, and that's not wrong. I want to just make sure that's a clear. I don't know how sometimes in church we get this mindset that it's wrong to be pretty, wrong to be beautiful. God made women. He made women beautiful. He made us attracted, us men. He made us attracted and allured by the beauty of women. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that in the story. The problem with this story and the problem today, guys, and it applies to women too, but guys, because I'm a guy, is when we see a beautiful woman and we decide to objectify her and think that just because she's beautiful, that's an object that we can take or do or talk about or think about however we want because she's beautiful. So when you read this story, what happens, David has all the power in the kingdom. He can do whatever he wants, and he sees something he likes, so he says, I want that. That's mine. And he objectifies this beautiful woman, and that causes the whole rest of the story to go through. So verse 6, Bathsheba's pregnant. So David sent word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite. And Joab sent him to David. When Uriah came to him, so Uriah was out fighting, Uriah comes home. David asked him how Joab was, how the soldiers were, and how the war was going. You know that's an awkward conversation for David. He's probably blushing and worried. Then David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. So Uriah left the palace, and a gift from the king was sent after him. But Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace with all the master's servants and did not go down to his house. So what's happening, right? David sleeps with this dude's wife. She gets pregnant. So bring that guy home so that when this guy has been off at war for who knows how long. And so his wife is gorgeous and he has not been intimate with her in a long time. So you would think when he comes home, he's going to go sleep with his wife. And David's thinking, she's pregnant. If I can bring him home and they sleep together, then no one will know why she's pregnant, right? Her husband got her pregnant. No one will know. I'm going to cover it all up. That's the plan. But, verse 8, Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace with all of his master's servants, and he doesn't go to his house. Verse 10, David was told Uriah did not go home. And so he asked him, have you not just come from a distance? Why would you not go home? Uriah said to David, the ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents, and my master Joab and my Lord's men are camped in open fields. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and to lie with my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing. How could I go have all this pleasure and all this reward and go sleep with my wife if my brothers who are off fighting and my warrior and the Lord and the commander and all these people are out there sacrificing their lives? How could I do that while they're out there sacrificing this? And so what you see is you see Uriah's integrity versus David's integrity, which is way down here at this point in the story. Uriah is being super, has a whole bunch of integrity, and David is trying to deceive Uriah. Then David said to him, "Stay here one more day, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. At David's invitation, he ate and he drank with him, and David made him drunk. David gets him drunk, right? Because if you get drunk, he'll probably go sleep with his wife. But in the evening, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat among his master's servants, and he did not go home. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab, and he sent it with Uriah. I mean, this is just cruel. In it, he wrote, "Put Uriah in the front line where the fighting is fiercest. Then withdraw from him so he will be struck down and die." So while Joab had the city under siege during this battle, he put Uriah at a place where he knew the strongest defenders were. When the men of the city came out and they fought against Joab, some of the men in David's army fell. Moreover, Uriah the Hittite died. So David can't get Uriah to sleep with his wife to blame the pregnancy on him. So he writes his own death warrant and gets Uriah to deliver his own death sentence to the commander, and the commander puts Uriah in the front of the battle. They withdraw from him, and Uriah dies. Now, you will skip down to verse 26 to save some time. When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. And after the time of mourning was over, David had her brought to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing David had done displeased the Lord. Hiding sin always results in more sin. Very simple, plain fact of life. When you sin and you try to cover it up and hide it, it always results in worse stuff. It always results in more sin. It always results in lying and then further actions that just dig that hole deeper and deeper. I'm sure many of you can relate. There was a time when you did something dumb, you tried to cover it up, not tell anyone and try to fix it all, right? Like there was times, I know plenty of times when I was a child and I did something like punched a hole in the wall or broke something in my house, right? And then you kind of fix it up or then you blame your brother. That happened a lot. Wade did it. That's my brother. I can blame him though. It's all right. I got away with most of that. But blame your brother and then whenever they find out, right, that that's not the case, the punishment is way worse. And the whole point is whenever you sin and you try to cover it up, you try to hide it, it always results in more sin. So in this story, number one, David commits adultery with this woman. Then he tries to cover it up, so he gets this guy drunk. Then the guy won't go sleep with his wife, so then he murders the guy. So David has broken, if you think about the Ten Commandments, David has broken the 6th, 7th, and 10th commandment in this one chapter of chapter 11. So that great King David that we all remembered from last month is not as perfect as we all thought. He's an adulterer. He's a coveter. He is a murderer. And so David is not as perfect as we all thought. And I love this story because David is a man after God's own heart, and we're going to see why that is. But we all fall and we all mess up. And that doesn't make it okay. That doesn't make it all right. But we all fall and we all mess up. And if David, this man who was so close to God, could fall so epically, then we can too. But what we're going to see is there is redemption from that. 2 Samuel chapter 12. So the Lord sent Nathan to David. Nathan is a prophet of the old times, so he's coming to David. When he came to him, he said, he's going to tell him a story. There were two men in a certain town. One was rich and the other was poor. One man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb that he had bought. He raised it. It grew up with him and his children. It shared his food. It drank from his cup. It even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man, who has everything he could ever want, refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveler who'd come to him. And instead, he took the ewe lamb, whatever that is. I need an agriculture person to instruct me. The ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man, and he prepared it for the one who had come to him. The rich man has everything he could want. He decides to take the one precious beloved lamb of this other man. David burned with anger against the man and said to Nathan, right? Nathan tells David this story, and David is the king, and so he's supposed to be just, and so he's burning with anger, right? As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing, and he had no pity. Then Nathan said to David, "You are that man." One, you want to talk about an epic setup, right? Thanks, Nathan. Super setup. But you are that man. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you king over Israel. I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you. I gave your master's wives into your arms. I gave you the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And if all of this would have been too little, I would have given you even more. I mean, I love this verse because I feel like I can hear the sadness and the brokenness of God. God hurts when we sin against Him. And you're hearing this, and David and God, they seem to just have such a close connection. And God is saying, David, look at how I've been by your side your whole life. I saved you from Goliath. I gave you the whole kingdom. I gave you everything you could want. Anything you could want, I gave to you. And if you would have told me this wasn't enough, I would have given you even more. Why? Verse 9. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword, and you took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword will never depart from your house because you despised me and you took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own. Number one, I think we see the sorrow of God, the brokenness of God from David's sin. Number two, Nathan is telling this to David. And I want to make sure we understand the context. David is the king. David has the whole kingdom, the whole army, and he can do whatever he wants, right? At this point in the story, the only one who knows what has happened is Nathan and Bathsheba. She's a part of the story, so I'm guessing she's not going to say anything. The only one who knows is Nathan. All David has to do is say, "Thanks, Nathan, for your opinion. Guard, cut his head off." Right? Problem solved. That's what David could do, whatever he wants. All he has to do is get rid of Nathan. But Nathan is so bold as a prophet that he comes to David. He risks his life to confront David. My point with this, as we're talking about sin and when you mess up in life, my point with this passage is that you have to have a Nathan. You need a Nathan in your life. And this is what I mean. You need someone who loves God and loves you enough to speak the truth and hold you accountable. People talk about their friends and how good friends are. You want to know what a true friend is? A true friend is someone who will tell you the truth when you're doing something wrong or when you're doing something stupid. A true friend is not someone who just pats you on the back and says, "It's all good, just keep going every step of life." No, a true friend is someone who loves God and loves you enough. They love you as an individual enough to tell you the truth. What you're doing is going to destroy your marriage. You need to stop. What you're doing is going to ruin your career. You need to stop. This is wrong. You need to stop. I think about in the New Testament, Jesus tells Peter, "Get behind me, Satan," at this one epic moment. We're thinking, Jesus is the love, you know, Jesus is love, right? He says, "Get behind me, Satan," Peter. He confronts Peter. And that was love. In the New Testament, Paul talks to Peter, two apostles, and Paul condemns Peter and calls him out for sin. That is love, because they care more about God and that individual than this artificial sugarcoating on the outside. Everything's all good and we're going to be buddy buddies, right? Nathan says, "I will put my life on the line because I love God and I love you enough that I'm going to confront you about your sin, even if you have all the rights and all the power to kill me." You need a Nathan in your life. Do you have someone When you mess up in your life, just take a second and think, do you honestly have someone who would come to you and tell you you're wrong? Because if you don't, that should be a very scary and worrying feeling in your life. If you don't have anyone who's bold enough and willing to say, hey, you need to fix some things. I'm not talking about someone who just is negative and condemns everything and complains. Not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about someone who loves you and is willing to say, hey, this is wrong and you need to fix it. Hey, you need to be a better husband. You need to be a better wife. What you're doing is not right. Hey, you need to be a better worker. Or whatever the situation, you need someone who will tell you that. We're going to go in the rest of the story, and David goes on to be still an amazing man after this story. But I don't want to miss that, where would this story be if David didn't have a Nathan? Where would this story, what would we think about David from here on out if Nathan didn't put his life on the line? If Nathan didn't care more about David's relationship with God than about Nathan's own relationship with David? Where would this story be? Verse 11, this is what the Lord says. Out of your own household, I'm going to bring calamity upon you. Before your very eyes, I will take your wives and I'll give them to one who is close to you, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight. You did this in secret, but I will do this thing in broad daylight before all of Israel. Sin has consequences. Next sermon point. Sin has consequences. When we sin against God, we sin against other people, there are consequences. Now, here is what I want to focus on today, pulling it together. This is what I want to focus on today. Up to this point in the story, David hasn't said anything since he had Uriah killed, right? He commits adultery, has this guy murdered. Nathan has just confronted him. He hasn't really said anything in the story yet until right now. This is David's response. David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. That's all he says. I have sinned against the Lord. And nothing more needs to be said. What I want to do, what I want to focus on today is the last section, I think, on your sermon notes, is what is the proper response to sin? I believe the most incredible part about this story is that when you sin and when you mess up and when you fall down in those times in your life, what does it look like to restore your relationship with God and with people? What does that look like to redeem and fix that? And I think David provides us with the perfect model of what it looks like to respond to sin. Because we all still know, I mean, how many of you, when you hear the word David, think adulterer or murderer first? I don't think many of us do. If you know the David from the Bible, I think many of us all say, man, he was an amazing man of God, a man after God's own heart. He was the king of Israel, this awesome man. Why would we say that? He's an adulterer. He's just committed adultery and coveting and murdered someone. Why in the world would we talk that highly of David? Why would we hold David in this high, high esteem? Why don't we treat David like Saul? We looked at Saul last month, right? Who sinned against God and fell down, and now we think Saul is like the saddest story in the Bible. Why don't we think of David like that? And I think it's all because of this right here. It's because of David's response to sin. Number one, David admits and he confesses. Verse 13, I have sinned against the Lord. Number one, David admits and he confesses. There's no excuses. By the way, excuses and God don't work. There's no denying. Denial and God doesn't work. He doesn't blame. Blaming and God don't work. It just doesn't mix, okay, before the Father. He doesn't make excuses. He doesn't blame. He doesn't say, well, why was she on the roof? Or why was that website exist where I could look at that? Or why was that girl wearing that clothing that made me do that? No, it's not blame. It's not excuse. No, I did this and I'm going to admit it and I'm going to confess it. And this applies to all things in life because so many people get wrapped up into this mindset. My father was an alcoholic, so that's why I'm an alcoholic. No, it's not. Now, you might be more prone to that for some reason. That is an excuse. And when you get before Jesus saying, well, my dad did that, so it's okay, or that's why I did that, doesn't work. It does not work. No excuses, no blaming. Lusting after others, forsaking your husband or your wife because they're not meeting your needs. No, doesn't work. Now, there's things we might need to fix in a relationship, and we can work on that. But blaming it on another person will not work before God until we get to the point of David. He doesn't say anything else. I have sinned against the Lord. That's what David says. Not, look at what she did, look at what they did, look at this, blah, blah, blah. No, I'll own up to it. I'm going to be a man. I'm going to own up to it. I admit and I confess I have sinned against the Lord. Nathan replied, "The Lord has taken away your sin." And this is what I love about the story, right? The moment that David says, "I have sinned against the Lord," the very next sentence, Nathan replied, "The Lord has taken away your sin." That when you get to that point where you put aside excuses and blaming and all of that and denial, when you get to the point where that's out of the picture and you just say, "God, I've sinned against you and I'm sorry." The next sentence, "The Lord has taken away your sin. You are not going to die. But because by doing this that you have made enemies of the Lord, shown utter contempt, the son born to you will die." After Nathan had gone home, the Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife had borne to David, and he became ill. David pleaded with God for the child. He fasted. He went into his house. He spent the nights lying on the ground. The elders of his household stood beside him to get him up from the ground, but he refused, and he would not eat any food with them. David admits and confesses, and number two, David repents. And this is a little different. Some people think it's the exact same thing, but David repents of his sin. And repenting is not just, "God, I'm sorry, and the next week I'm going to go on keeping and doing the same thing." That is not where David's heart is right now. David is repenting in action for what he has done against God. Now here's the thing. They have this child, and now this child is sick. On the seventh day, the child died. David's servants were afraid to tell him that the child was dead, for they thought, "While the child was living, he spoke to David, but he would not listen to us. How can we tell him the child is dead? He might do something desperate." David noticed that the servants were whispering among themselves. He realizes the child was dead, and he asked, "Is the child dead?" "Yes," they replied, "he is dead." So David has done this sin. He sleeps with this woman. She gets pregnant. She has a kid. Okay, she has a child. The child gets sick. David fasts and he weeps before God. He cries out to God, "Please save him, please save him. Do anything to save him." And the child passes away. Verse 20, David got up from the ground. After he had washed, he put lotions and changed his clothes. He went into the house of the Lord and worshiped. Then he went to his own house, and at his request, he served his food and he ate. David accepts the consequences. God says, "You sinned. These are the consequences." And David, before the consequences happen, he weeps, he fasts, he cries out before God, "Please, God, change it. Please, God, change it. Please, God, fix it." He's crying out to God, but God says, "You sinned. I've forgiven your sin, but sin still has consequences." And one of the hardest things, a lot of us get the first two points. Yeah, I need to admit my sin. I need to repent of my sin. But a lot of us aren't willing to accept that when we sin, it has consequences. That is just the way that God created the world. There are consequences. And when you are forgiven, it doesn't mean there are no consequences. But David doesn't blame God, right? At this moment in the story, David could blame God. "Why would you do that? How could you do that?" And he doesn't do that. Because he says, "It was my fault. And I tried and I pleaded and I fasted. Maybe God would have changed his mind, but he didn't. These are the consequences for my sin. There's nothing I can do about that because I already sinned. These are the consequences." And so he accepts the consequences for his sin. Verse 21, we're going to finish the story up. His servants asked him, "Why are you acting this way? While the child was alive, you fasted and you wept, but now that the child is dead, you get up and eat?" He answered, "While the child was still alive, I fasted and I wept, and I thought, 'Who knows? The Lord may be gracious to me and let the child live. But now that he is dead, why should I fast? Can I bring him back again? I will go to him one day, but he will not return to me.'" Then David comforted his wife Bathsheba. He went to her and he laid with her. she gave birth to another son, and they named him Solomon. The Lord loved him, and because the Lord loved him, he sent word through Nathan the prophet to name him Jedidiah, meaning loved by the Lord. There's 4 points that I think whenever you sin, whenever you fall down, and as we look at this story, I think there's 4 points for how are we supposed to respond to sin. And all 3 of these are insanely super important. But I think most of us stop around 2 or 3 and we don't get this. And if you don't get the 4th point, you haven't moved on from sin. David moves on. When I was a teenager, 16 or 17, I don't know, I did something really stupid. I mean, we all do something really stupid. And honestly, I don't remember exactly what stupid thing I did because there was several of them. But I remember doing something bad, something sinful. I don't remember what it was, like I said. I'm trying to remember what it was. I did something sinful, and I was 16 or 17, and I was broken up about it. At this time in my life, I was active in church, I was leading worship for stuff, and so I wasn't like a bad person, but I did something and I knew I wasn't supposed to do, and it was bad, and I felt so guilty, and I felt so much shame, especially because, like, Calvin, you're supposed to be a leader, right? You're supposed to do that. And so I just felt this guilt and this shame, and I had done this, several weeks before, and basically I was moping around, sulking, and I remember being at my house, and I was on my room one day, and I was reading my Bible, and I was praying, and I felt so bad, and this happened weeks ago, and I had already, confessed this to God and said, I'm sorry I did this and all this stuff. And my mom, if any of you get the chance to meet my mom when she comes once or twice a month, she's a wonderful lady. You should totally meet her. She's also, in my opinion, one of the funniest people I know. She walked in the room, and you think your mom, right? Your mom is like your care bear, right? They love you. My mom walks in the room. I'm like broken on the ground. And she walks in. She looks at me, and she's like, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "Mom, I sinned, and I just feel so bad, and I can't do this." She's all, "Did you tell God?" "Yes, I confessed it to God like weeks ago, but I just feel so bad." Get up and stop sulking. Move on. Right? And you're probably expecting some more epic words from a parent. My wonderful, lovely mom, "Calvin, get up. What are you doing? You confessed your sin. Get up and move on with life. God's not sitting there throwing a pity party with you. Get up. Move on. You can't go back and change it." I love that song we sang, "Those regrets have no more hold on me." I don't remember how it goes, but "I'm not going to let those regrets have any hold on me." I love that song because move on, right? This is all very serious. What David does is very serious. And admitting your sin and repenting of your sin and the consequences for sin are all very serious. But man, at some point you have to get back on your feet and realize that there's a whole nother rest of life to live. Get up. You can't change it. God knows it. Move on. So many of us had something that we did in our past, or maybe was done to us in our past, and we just let it hold us down and we refuse to move on from it. Listen, God wants you to move forward. That is not freedom from sin. If it's still tangling your mind and just every day you're depressed and worried and anxious about it and you feel shame and you feel guilt from it, listen, that's not the gospel. The gospel is forgiveness and grace and mercy. Move on. If your past, and it can be yesterday, it can be a year ago, it can be your childhood, if your past is still holding on to you, you haven't given it all the way to Jesus. Give it to Jesus. He'll come to you as soon as David says, "I have sinned against the Lord." The next verse, "The Lord has taken away your sin." Man, give it to God and move on. Give it to God and move on. There is nothing sadder than meeting a Christian, knowing that they know God and they've given their life to God, and knowing that they want to have this intense, personal, deep relationship with God, but that they still let things in the past hold them down and prevent them from being who they're supposed to be today. There's a little phrase that I tell myself. I started telling myself this. It's, once again, not that super profound, but I think we should all be able to say it. He's still God and I'm still loved. He's still God and I'm still loved. Sorry you did that. Yes, it was stupid. Yes, there's consequences. He's still God and you're still loved. Face the consequences and move on. That's it. And my whole thing today is, man, I just, as we read the story of David, the rest of David, we're going to finish out David this month, and we're going to see David is an amazing man. And this one story doesn't define David's life. David's past doesn't define his future. Your past should not define your future. This one act in David's life doesn't define his future. We all still think of David as this amazing king of Israel, amazing man after God's own heart, because when he sinned, he owned up to it, he accepted the consequences, and then he got up and he moved on. David does not let his past define his future. So I want to wrap this up with three questions. Number one, do I have someone who would hold me accountable like Nathan did for David? On your little clipboard, I want you to just answer that to yourself. Do I have someone who would be like Nathan for me? If you don't, you need a Nathan. You need someone who can help you. I remember, this is probably a bad example, but I remember when I was a youth and partying and, you know, you go to a party and everyone's drinking and stuff. This is probably an awful example. Doesn't really help with this story. But at the party, I remember having friends and being friends who, and having a friend who didn't drink. And, you know, the friend who would say, like, you're too drunk to drive. And then when you're drunk, you think you can rule the world. So you're like, no, I'm not. I'm going to drive. Right? And you're being really stupid. And you maybe ever heard the story about your friend who punched you in your face and knocked you out so you wouldn't drive home. You need a friend who will punch you in the face so you don't drive home drunk. Now, I don't know, like, how much I can prove from that from the Bible. My point is, you need a Nathan. You need someone who's not going to say, oh, yeah, great, go get in your car, be cool. I'm not going to, because I don't want to have a confrontation with you or feel awkward, so I'm going to let you go drive your truck and possibly die or kill someone else. You need the friend who's going to say, hey, no, you can't do that, and I'm going to stand in front of you, and if you even hit me in the mouth, you know, I'm going to try to wrestle you in the ground, even if you beat me up, whatever. I'm not going to let you do something really, really stupid with your life. You need a Nathan who, when you mess up and when you do something wrong or you're going to do something wrong, man, they're there for you. They can look out for those warning signs. They can call you out on sin. You need a Nathan. So number one, do you have someone who can hold you accountable like Nathan did for David? If you don't have someone, if you know someone that could be that for you, ask them. If you don't, tell me. Put it on a Connect card. That's not an option. I need a Nathan. Whatever. Write it in. I need a Nathan. Listen, we have house churches, we have discipleship, and I promise most of the Nathans in this room come from those things. So if you need someone, put that down. Number two, have I been making excuses and not owning up to mistakes and sin in my own life? One of the, probably the biggest change of maturity in a person's life is when they realize, I am responsible for me. Have you been making excuses and not owning up to mistakes and sin in your life? Have you been saying, well, so-and-so did that, that's why I did this. So-and-so did this, that's why I did this. That just doesn't work. I'm sorry. Sorry that happened. Sorry that's the situation or the circumstance. But you're letting situations and circumstances control you instead of you having self-control over them. So have I been making excuses and not owning up to mistakes and sin in my own life? And number three, is there something I need to let go of and move on from? I want you to just take a second. We're going to pray about this one last question. And I just want you to think, is there something that, man, I just need to say, Jesus, sorry I did this. I know you still love me and you're still God. I'm yours and I want to move forward. Is there something I need to let go of and move on from? Let's pray.